Mosai. We're back on stage, back into action here, Rav Mosai. Okay. We're on Daf Yutesamid Beis, and we're actually on line number 9, which starts with the word Be'ohalecha. But to bring you up to date with a very short review of what we have to know, is that there's a pasuk in Eov, of all places. And the pasuk in Eov says, Al tishkan bi'ohalecha avla, which is interpreted to mean, don't leave a dangerous thing, a bomb, so to speak, in your house. Get rid of it. It's dangerous. You know, it's sort of like, I remember when I got leave from the army, and they gave me so many rules about how do I tie up my gun, you know, in 3 different locks so my kids wouldn't play around with the gun. I mean, we know that it's happened that children have played with guns and terrible catastrophes. So the pasuk in Eov tells you get rid of this object. It's a bomb. Now the question is, what is this dangerous bomb? So there are 2 opinions that we covered last week. And those are on line 4, that of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. And he says what you have to get rid of is what's called a shtar parua. A shtar parua means that the love has already paid up the chov. Now normally, if all things are equal, when the love pays up the chov, what does he take back?
Like the receipt.
Forget about receipts. That's another sugya, which we're not getting into. But assuming there's no such thing as a receipt, which I'm not going to get into now, he takes back the shtar. In this particular case, for any reason, that's irrelevant to our discussion tonight. So don't even ask me why, and don't even think about why, because it's going to just take you off the track. He, the lover, did not take back the shtar. So who's holding on to the shtar then? The malva, correct? That's a very dangerous thing. And says Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, the halacha cannot tolerate that. Because what happens down the line if the malva doesn't remember that he got paid up? What's he going to do with the shtar? He's going to use it against the lover. And he's got a perfectly good shtar against the lover. So we can't allow that. The malva therefore has to rip up the shtar. That's the opinion of who? Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Then if you fast forward a few lines, the Gemara quotes Rav. And he says, no, that this pasuk is referring not to a shtar parua that was paid up, but rather to a shtar amana. So let's just quickly review what amana means. Amana comes from the language of trust. And the love says to 2 edim, write me up a shtar that I borrowed such and such amount of money from the malva. In fact, I'm going to take this shtar once you sign it, and I'm going to give it over to the malva, but the malva is going to be trusted by me not to use the shtar against me, because at this point in time, I'm not interested in taking the money and taking the loan. I want the malva to have this shtar locked up in a very tight, secure place in event that I need the money. And maybe I'll be very desperate. You know, today, if you're desperate for money, you say to somebody, wire me the money. But they didn't have wiring in those days. And writing a shtar was a whole to-do. Is that how the South Africans say it? A whole to-do? Did I get that right?
We don't say wire anymore.
No, not wiring. Nobody wires money anymore.
No,
but to-do. Isn't there a phrase? Rabbi Myers always says it's a whole to-do. I don't know.
It's a whole to-do.
I'm trying to learn these South African phrases. I'm not up to scratch yet. Shame, right? Anyway, how are you? Aleichem Shalom, good to see you. So to write up a shtar is not a simple matter. It takes a lot of time. You know, you got to buy the cloth, and you got to get the sofer and pay him his fee.
And aid him, right?
And aid him and get them signed. So I would like everything to be prepared that in event I need urgently what we call dachuf, I need the money, the malva will just give me the money and he's holding on to the shtar, but I trust him. So the halacha does not tolerate such a shtar, because that too is a dangerous bomb in the hands of the malva. You never know, maybe the malva will deliberately or more likely inadvertently use the shtar against the lova, when in fact the lova never got the money. There was never a loan. So what we're up to now is line number 9. on Daf Yud Tes Amid Beis. And the Gemara says the following. Is there a machlokis here between Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi and Rav? Meaning, each one of them, respectively, is interpreting this pasuk, and the pasuk is objecting to holding on to this invalid shtar. But is one worse than the other? It's even more dangerous and more objectionable in the eyes of the halacha, so that one man, the other, mentions the less objectionable one, allowing you to figure out by law of kal v'chomer the more objectionable one. Whereas the other one says, no, only the more objectionable one, that's more dangerous, that has to be get rid of. That's going to be a violation of Al Tishkon B'Olecha Afla. But the less dangerous one, maybe we could learn to tolerate it and live with it and let the Malva be. That's the subject of this sukkah. So Gemara says the following. Man diomer shtar parua, according to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, who maintains that the pasuk in Iyov that prohibits you holding on to the shtar, the malv has to get rid of the shtar, is referring to a shtar that was paid up, is kol shken, how much more so in the case of a shtar amona? In other words, the Gemara is interpreting that Rabbi Shimon Levi is saying even a shtar parua has to be gotten rid of. It's intolerable. How much more so a shtar amona? Now we're going to have to rack our brains and figure out why is it that a shtar amona is that much worse than a shtar parua? But hold on. Then we have man diomar shtar amona. We have the opinion of Rav, who said that, you know what the pasuk is objecting to? It's a shtar amona. I will shtar parua lo, even though the lov is already paid up the chov, the malva could still hold on to the shtar. He doesn't have to get rid of it, according to the second opinion. So now the Gemara has to tell us, why would we allow the malva to hold on to a shtar parua? It seems like an avla. It's a terrible thing. How can we tolerate such a thing that the malva leave around a shtar amona? I'm sorry, a shtar parua. And nobody tolerates a shtar amona. That has to be gotten rid of. Kuli alma lo pligi, les man de polig, the avla gedola is to leave around a shtar amona. It was never a loan to begin with. You can't hold on to a shtar which testifies to a loan when that money was never given. Okay, now we can get started. All right. You see, he didn't forget you. But a shtar parua we can tolerate. And I would say just the opposite. You know, a shtar right? Parua is a paid up shtar.
In other words, will be stamped on it that it's been paid.
No, it hasn't been stamped. That's the problem. The malva is holding on to a shtar that was paid up, but it's not stamped. And that, according to the Gemara, whether or not we can allow the malva to hold on to the shtar, you know, keep it up there in his attic, is a machlokes between Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi and Rav.
The malva is the person who gave the loan.
Right, right. That you have to write down, because I'm not going to remember always to translate the word malva.
I was just going to make sure.
Yeah. If I had a blackboard, actually is here a blackboard, technically.
No, but that's
I never used it.
That's very dangerous.
So you and I would say it's very dangerous, and in fact that's what Rabbi Yeshua says. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, don't tolerate leaving a shtar parua that's already been paid up in the hands of the malva. It's a dangerous weapon. This shtar was already paid up. How can you leave it in the hands of the malva? Who's the malva again? The lender. Okay, but I'm not going to say it over and over again, because I can't remember. I can't remember all the time, you know. However, comes along Rav, and Rav says, a shtar amona we have to get rid of. That we can't tolerate. But a shtar parua we can tolerate. Why? Seems very odd. A shtar parua is a very dangerous kind of weapon in the hands of the malva. So the Gemara explains. You know what justifies the malva holding on to the shtar parua? De zimnin de mashile apshite de safra. So what I'm going to try to offer here is a literal translation of the Gemara, word for word, so that you get familiar with Aramaic, and then I'm going to give you a little bit of a background to embellish it. Zimnan means it might happen, it's frequently, right? It happens at times. Demashile, that he delays it, what it really means here is he holds on to it. And who's holding on to it? The Malva is holding on to it. Apshiti de safre. Pshiti means the wage that has to be paid to the scribe. Now let's understand. Scribes don't work for free. They got to get paid. Certainly a scribe who writes a Sefer Torah, that we all know how much they get paid. Oh my gosh. To donate a Sefer Torah these days, you got to be a wealthy guy. You know what I mean? Now, I was recently at a Sefer in your former neck of the woods in Efrat, and what they did was they saved a Sefer Torah from the Holocaust, and they had it rewritten. And then they had a dedication service in Zayit or someplace there in Efrat. I don't know. There were olives floating all over the place. Anyway, but it turns out that it cost them more to reconstruct that sefer that was half burnt in the Holocaust than it cost to start from scratch.
Wow!
But it was a very meaningful thing because it was a sefer Torah that belonged to their family before the Holocaust. There's a whole to-do about that. Okay, fine. Now, how much do you pay a scribe to write up a shtar? I don't know, but it's not an insignificant sum. And we have to ask ourselves the following question. According to halacha, somebody's got to pay the scribe. Who's going to pay the scribe? Who actually hires the scribe? Is the sofa working for the malva? Is he working on behalf of the lender? Or is he working for the lova, the borrower?
Or both of them, can it be?
I don't know if it's both of them. I'll tell you why. Somebody has to pay him. And if we're going to wait until we get these guys together, I don't know. You know, the scribe wants to know that so-and-so is responsible to pay me. So who would you say gains by the shtar and therefore should write L'chor the Malva, right?
He's the one who needs it in order to make the claim.
Right. So it's very interesting, Max. And this is like counterintuitive. Is that how they say it? It's the lova who has to pay for the writing of the shtar.
Then of course he can't get the loan.
Exactly.
That's what we do at the banks all the time. Who pays the fees? You pay the fees.
You pay the fees.
You pay the fees at the bank, yeah.
The bank charges your bank fees.
You pay the fees, so that's the exact opposite of halacha, you say. No. Because you're the lender. Here, you're the lender. Here, the borrower is paying. You see, we get confused with this malva and lova. Should we drop the English?
The malva and the lova.
Can we stick to malva and lova again? In halacha, it's the lova who pays the fees. In the bank, it's the malva who pays the fees. Correct? Because you're depositing your money in the bank. You're the malva, right?
But in the case of the bank,
is that clear? I mean,
the reason why
you realize that you're the malva when you put money in the bank.
Yeah, but the bank charges you as well.
In fact, the question is, how can you, as a malva, take ribbis when the bank gives you interest on your money? That's a difficult child. But we're not getting into that because we'll never get out of it. That's Heter Iska. That's very common.
His mashal was, I think, was that like, it's whoever needs is the, and requires financial services. I need a place to hold my money, so I have to pay the bank for it. I need a loan, so I need to pay COVID.
Okay, maybe.
Whoever's the benefit,
pays the fees.
If it was up to me, I would say the bank should be paying all the fees because they're the ones who are ultimately making the money.
All the money in your bank.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah. Trouble is that my bank is going to go down the tubes, right? Because I'm paying all these fees. But be that as it may, the lova has to pay the scribe. The reason for that, Rabotzai, is a very profound halachic reason. And it's called Das HaMeschayev. What that means is that the creator of the shtar, if you can write this down, because again, I don't have a blackboard, but it should be on a blackboard. The creator of the shtar, from a halachic perspective, is always the person who loses as a result of that shtar. Who's going to lose as a result of the shtar? In other words, the shtar testifies on behalf of someone and against someone. The one about whom the shtar testifies against, called the victim of the shtar, He's called the Mischayev. Okay, in fancy Hebrew, the Mitchayev. Okay? Okay, now you got it. Okay. He's the Mischayev. And the Mischayev always has to create the shtar.
So
who is the Mischayev in the case of a shtar milva, clearly?
The Lova.
And therefore the Lova has to create the shtar. Basically, the Edim are always testifying on what's called the Das HaMischayev, meaning the agreement of the Mischayev. Now, for example, if I'm selling my land, and the assumption of Halacha is that only a person who's desperate would sell real estate, because otherwise everyone wants to hold on to real estate, he's called the Mischayev. So who's going to commission the Edim to write the Shtar? Is it going to be the Mocher or the Lokeach? The answer is the Mocher. Okay? Why? Because the Mocher is called the Mischayev. And it goes on and on and on.
So Rabbi, does this mean that in case of a ketubah, the Baal is the victim?
Correct. The Baal is the victim, he's the Mischayev, and he has to commission the writing of the Shtar. That's why at a wedding, I make sure I have an extra yarmulke, and I sit down in front of two Edim with the Chassan, and I ask the Chassan to pick up the yarmulke, after I explain to him why he's doing this silly looking thing, and I'm telling him that that's Das HaMischayev for the Ksuba. And then and only then can the Edim sign the Ksuba. But first they have to be there to hear the Das HaMischayev of the Baal, because he's the Mischayev. And that Ksuba is given from the Baal over to whom? To the Isha. She now becomes the Malva, so to speak, the replacement of the Malva, and she'll use that Ksuba against her husband, just the way the Malva will use that Shtar against the Lova, because the Mischayev wrote the Shtar and passed on the Shtar to the one who benefits from the testimony of the Shtar. So the writing of the Shtar, including the payment of what we call Pshitei de Safra, is the responsibility of the Lova. But guess what? Who's got more money in his pocket? The Malva or the Lova? Clearly,
after
the Malva. Right, right. That's it. But clearly it's the Malva, correct?
Right.
It's very possible that not only is the Lova desperate for the funds, he's even so down and out, his pocket can be turned inside out, and the only thing that comes out of it is a dirty tissue, and he can't even pay the Pshita the Saf. The Malva is a great tzaddik. He's lending his money, interest-free loan. So you know what? He's going to be even greater of a tzaddik. Not only is he going to lend him money, he's also going to lend him money, or lay out the money, for the payment of the sofer. Okay? Now, let's say the sofer's fee was 5 zuz. Now the Malva wants to get paid 5 zuz. Not only does he want to get paid 100 zuz because that was the loan, he wants an extra 5 zuz because he shelled out on behalf of the Lova to pay the scribe to write the Shtar. So the Gemara says that we've got to give the Malva some security over the Lova, so that even though the Lova comes back to pay his 100 zuz, meaning the value of the loan, he hasn't yet added the extra 5 zuz to cover the expense and reimburse the Malva for having shelled out to pay the sofer. Let the shtar remain in the hands of the Malva. That's going to move the Lova to pay up the extra 5 zuz. Now follow what happens.
But then if it's still in his hands, he can still make the whole claim. How do you know
that? Okay, so I'm just saying that there is some sort of meaning or justification to allow the Malva to hold on to the shtar, even though it was parua, even though the Lova paid up the loan itself, but he hasn't yet paid and reimbursed the Malva for the layout of the Pshitei de Safra, for the money for the sofer. So therefore, we're going to look aside, according to the second opinion, against that's the opinion of Rav, and allow the Malva to hold on to the shtar as a security, to pressure, if you pardon the phrase, the Lova to pay him up for Pshiti the Safra. When the Lova pays the extra 5 zuz, at that point the Malva has to give him the shtar.
Does the Lova take a shofar?
Well, again, if the Malva has no shtar, there's no need to provide the Lova with a shofar. Why? Because the Malva could not claim a thing without the shtar.
Was he has the shtar and it's already been paid back, but he's still holding on to it for the 5 zuz.
That's very dangerous. So yeah. According to the first opinion, Rabbi Shimon ben Levi, how can we allow the malva to hold on to the shtar just because of the 5 zuz for pshita the safre? That's not fair. In the broader perspective of things, that doesn't shine a candle to the 100 zuz that he got paid back. Comes along Rav and he says, a shtar amana we can't tolerate, because in that case the lova never got the money at all from the malva, and the whole 100 zuz is that. But here, in the case of a shtar parua, as we say in Yiddish, the kendoch given a kvetch, and we can allow somehow with a kvetch that the malva hold on to the shtar. Why is the malva allowed to hold on to the shtar? Because that's his guarantee of security to get paid, or reimbursed, I should say, for the pshite de safra.
Is the sofer's fee written into the shtar?
No.
So it's a common practice.
Correct. That's the problem. The problem is that, you know, there's no documentation that could support the claim of the malva with regard to pshite de safra. Maybe that would be a good solution to the problem. And the malva should get 2 stars from the lova.
Right.
But that would require another pshita de safra. And imagine the lova couldn't even pay the first star. Now he's going to have to pay for a second star for the pshita de safra of the first star. And then it goes on to the third star and ad infinitum. So that's the sugya here of pshita de safra. Itmar, we learned in a braisa, sefer she'ena muge, omar av ami, at shloshim yom mutal lishoso mikan vielich osel lishoso mishum shenemar al tishkon biolecha af. The same pasuk in Iyov that prohibits you from holding on to something that's dangerous and leaving it around your house because it might be misused applies, says Rav Ami, to the case of a sefer. Now, Rabosai, I'm going to suggest a pshat which is not Rashi's pshat. Because I just want to show you what bothered Rashi, because I think if I were to ask you for a knee-jerk response, what does the word sefer mean? I hope, you would all give me the same answer that I came up with Rashi somehow is not willing to tolerate that. What does the word sefer mean?
A book.
What?
A book.
A book. A book. What's so terrible about keeping a book around? You know, I have tons of books which are full of mistakes. You know, that's the way it works. You know, especially these days, you know, there are printing errors all over the place. In fact, if you would go through my library, you'd probably find every other sefer I have little notes on the side about all the printing errors, you know, and so forth and so on. So nobody came up with the answer that I came up with, but I'm just going to tell you what I thought the word sefer means. I thought the word sefer means a sefer Torah. That's what I thought, a sefer Torah. A sefer Torah, if you leave it around, and it's eino muger, which means it has mistakes in it, somebody might mistakenly think it's a perfectly good sefer Torah. Today they do this, you've seen it, how they bind it with the gartel, you know what I'm talking about? But leave out the gartel for a moment. And I don't want to keep around my house a sefer Torah that needs to be corrected, because it might get used. Rashi's not happy with the pshat. Why? Because Rashi holds like Aaron holds, that there's more to Torah than just the sefer Torah. The purpose of Torah is not just that public reading of the Torah twice a week on Mondays and Thursdays, another 2 times on Shabbos. That's all very, very important. But Torah means Mesoras HaTorah, means the transition of Torah, the transmission of Torah from one generation to the other. So Rashi says that the word Torah, if you'll take a look, this is 4 lines down from the top, he says, Torah Devim Uksuvim. Now, you might ask, well, Torah Nevi'im and Ksuvim, come on, today you've got published Tanakhs. Okay, but back in the day, when you had a hold of a Tanakh, it was a manuscript form. I mean, Rashi was way before the printing press, and certainly Rav Ami was way before the printing press. So there were mistakes. Now imagine, Max, you have your own copy of the 5 books of Moses, and it has mistakes in it. That could create a whole tradition, because you're going to teach from that to your children, your grandchildren. And I've got a chumash that has other mistakes in it. Before you know it, it's a whole balagan. In fact, I'm even suspicious that if you're not careful about a sefer, somebody might get a hold of it and start making his own amendations. You know, he thinks that you have the wrong text, and he's got the right tradition, because in his text is a different word. So he just makes a little bit of a mark in your thing, and he adds a vav here and a hey there. That's not good. Like this little boy who was walking with his father in London, and his father pointed out the Big Ben. So the son turns to his father and he says, "Dad, why did they put this clock so high up?" So he said, "Listen, son, it's very simple. Everyone goes by, checks his clock, and he looks at the Big Ben. He thinks it's off by a little bit. So everybody manipulates the Big Ben to fit his clock. That's why they put it on high." Chazal say that Moshe Rabbeinu had his Sefer Torah, in addition to the 12 Sefer Torah, the Shvatim, that if Chas V'Shalom would be a discrepancy, they would go back to Moshe's Sefer. That was held on the lock and key, and that would be the final determining nusach of the Torah. But be that as it may, Rashi's worried not only about Torah, he's worried about Nevi'im, and he's worried about Ksuv. Fine, that's all of Tanakh. Now here, I want to tell you that the Rush says that Rashi wants to tell you even Tanakh. But how much more so in the case of a Gemara, in the case of a Shulchan Aruch, in the case of Sifrei HaPoskim. Because in the case of Tanakh, obviously it's critical that we have the proper Nusach. But we're not paskening halachas from Tanakh. But if you have a sefer of Psak and it's being used for actually deciding halacha, it's got to be muga, it's got to be corrected. Sometimes the difference of two words or two letters even could make a difference in a life and death situation if it's in the wrong text. And Rashi is telling you that even Tanakh, which is the Torah of Chsav, has to always be muga. However, it takes a while to clarify and correct a sefer. It's not something that happens overnight. So we got to give him a certain allowance of time. How much time will we give him? Who remembers? Up to, let's read it again, Omer Avami, Ad Shloshim Yom Mutar Lashos. Now this is interesting because we find very often that when you have the barest minimum amount of time, it's 30 days. Like for example, a mezuzah, you can leave around for 30 days without putting it up, at least in the chutzlar, I don't know about here. Or for example, you don't impose taxes on a person until he lives there for a month. Another example would be a Nazir, except upon himself Nazirus, but he wanted the minimum amount of Nazirus, that's 30 days. Or for example, you have Halva, if I extend you a loan, you have a minimum amount of 30 days at least. Minimum amounts are always 30 days. And 30 days represents a perek of Zman. In the laws of Avelus, for example, Stam Avelus is 30 days, okay, for Avvimo, but even for Avvimo, the real basic nitty-gritty of Velus is 30 days. In the case of Chos of a Kala, the Kala has certain special status in Dinim, on Yom Kippur, and so forth, 30 days. Everything is 30 days. In fact, at what point does a fetus, once born, become viable according to Allah? 30 days. And that's why Pidgin HaBen is always after the 30th day. So you see that the number 30 with regard to Perek of Zman is critical. We're going to give you the barest time unit that's meaningful enough to guarantee that within that time period you'll make sure that things are fixed up. We're not going to ask you to burn this sefer because, you know, you found the mistake. We'll give you a little bit at the time. But if you go beyond that time, then you violate the Iser of Altishkan Biolecha Av. That's what we have so far. Omer Rav Nachman. Okay, now we start a new sugya. Now, just by way of introduction, the rule is the following. Once Adam testify, that's it. As soon as the testimony is over, that's a closed unit. Finito, curtains, they cannot come back and add, subtract, or multiply their edus. Excellent. In the case of a shtar, the completion of their edus is simultaneous with the writing and the signing of the shtar. Once the signed shtar is edim hachasum al shtar, havi kamisha nechre edusam bebezdin, and the edim cannot add or subtract to their edus. However, there is one exception, and that's our Mishnah that we learned on Daf Yud Ches. And the Mishnah establishes that if the shtar needs kiyum, meaning it has to be authenticated, because the Chachamim were not happy with a shtar when the shtar might be counterfeit. We don't know that these signatures are actually the signatures of the Eidim. Maybe somebody forged their signatures. That's called a ziyuf or a forgery. So the shtar at this point is up in the air. It's not valid until such time as kuyu kumakayim the shtar. Now, there may be many ways of being mekayim the shtar and certifying that the signatures on the shtar are authentic. But if all fails, and we were not successful in authenticating the shtar, and the shtar at this point, as I said, is in limbo, then whom should we invite into the Bezdin in order to authenticate the signatures of being mekayim the shtar? What's the answer to that?
The witnesses.
The witnesses themselves. Oh, says the Gemara, at this point, the witnesses have a very special nemonus, a credibility that comes under a separate category and is not Avis. Because again, we cannot listen to them as Adim to say anything about the shtar. That they can't do because Kevin Shehigid, but we have another category. And what's that category called? Again, I've been trying for a few weeks to, you know, to impress this into your brain. Who remembers Bonanza? You remember? No, nobody knows what I'm talking about. You know, when you, you know, okay. So that's called Hapesha Asar Hu Hapeshiti. What does that mean? Since the shtar at the present moment is invalid, if the Eidim are the only way, the only source we have to validate the shtar, and they tell you something about the psul of the shtar, that means the shtar is invalid, we have to believe them through the principle of credibility, peshas or peshahit. Therefore, if the Eidim say, yes, we signed the shtar, but we were ktanim, we were psulim, we were anusim, which means basically that the shtar is worthless, it's not a shtar, because a shtar signed by Eidim Psulim or Eidim Ketanim or Eidim Anusim is not a shtar, then we have to believe them. That's called HaPeh She'asar Hu HaPeh Shehiti. Comes along Rav Nachman and he says the following: Eidim She'amru, yes, we signed the shtar, but Amana Hayud Vareno, this shtar was a shtar Amana. The Lovit told us to sign a shtar in case in the future he will decide that he's pressed for money and he'll borrow the money. But right now, he's not borrowing a single cent. Well, l'chora, I would say, let's believe the Eidim, because there's no other way of being mekayim the shtar. And if Eidim have the power of peshas or peshahit, says Rav Nachman, ein ne'emonim, the Eidim are not believed. What happened to Peshas or Peshahit there? I don't know. Then Rav Nachman goes on and says, Moda Hayudvarim, if the same Eidim who come to be Mekayim the Shtar, instead of saying, would I lose it? Amana Hayudvarinu. They say, Moda Hayudvarinu. Is once again a nemon. Now, what's a moda?
Who's claiming the shtar in this case? Because
the malva has a shtar,
but the lova never borrowed any money.
Well, we don't know that.
Okay.
We don't know that. I mean, all we know is what we see in front of our eyes. There's a shtar signed by two kosher eidim. And not only that, the eidim don't even deny that they signed the shtar, so they authenticate their own signatures. Now the eidim want to tell us the whole story. Yeah, we signed the shtar, but you know what? The shtar was a shtar amon. And the lover never got the money. Or the shtar was a shtar modah. What's a shtar modah? We said earlier that the mocher has to commission the writing of the shtar. And in this case, according to the claim of the eidim, the mocher had no interest whatsoever in selling his karka. He was forced to do so under duress. And what he did was, he notified the two witnesses that, look, I'm going to have to commission you to write this shtar because otherwise they're going to knock my block off. But you should know that it's a shtar modah. I'm notifying you that I had no interest in selling my field. It's like, you know, the HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes the har and kof aleim har kigigis, you know, and he says, you know, if you don't take the Torah and accept it, I'm going to destroy you right now. So you better accept the Torah. Nikan l'modah rava lo raisa, the Gemara says. And that's what a modah is. A modah is when I notify the witnesses on the sly, on the QT. I can't tell them publicly because I get my head blocked off. But you should know I'm being compelled under duress to agree to sell my karka. I'm not interested at all in this transaction. The eidim come forward. And now they claim, yes, the lokeach has the shtar, the buyer has the shtar. And it says that the mocher sold him the karka. That's true, we signed the shtar. But we only signed the shtar because the mocher notified us that he's in an urgent situation. And if we don't write up the shtar, he's going to get killed by the mafiosos. The eidim are not believed.
But if the eidim themselves were, I'm assuming they would be believed. But the fact that the...
Why?
Yeah.
Why would it be that if the Edom say that we were anusim to sign the shtar, then based on Peshas and Peshit, do we believe them? But if they claim that the mocher was anus, he was compelled, and he notified us with this modah, they're not believed. That's the subject of this long tosfos here, Dibra Maschil Omar Rav Nachman. But before we read this Tosfos, I want to just point out to you that not everyone agrees with Rav Nachman. And we should keep this in mind as we go through the Tosfos. Because the Gemara now establishes that Mar Baravashi Omar, Amana Hayu Dvarenu Ein Ne'emonim. And that we can understand because imagine what the Edom are saying about themselves and their own character when they admit that this was a shtar amana, and they what?
Which they should not have signed.
They should not have signed because, as we said before, the halacha has zero tolerance for a shtar amana. Now, if the eidim are saying something that would incriminate themselves, that's called ein odem meisim atzma rasha. So there's no way that we can accept what they're saying. That much, Mar Baravashi says I can explain. But modah hayudvareinu, that's not self-incrimination, because on the contrary, to save the neck of the mocher in this case, they should have certainly written up the shtar, and therefore their money. And Mar Rav Ashi has a simple explanation for this distinction. He says, "My timer, hi nitan li kosev." In the case of a shtar modah, the eidim are allowed. I would even add, obligated to write up the shtar. So there's no self-incrimination when the eidim testify that this is a shtar modah. But hi, the case of a shtar amana, lo nitan li kosev. You're not allowed to write such a shtar. And therefore, when the eidim testify about themselves that they wrote up a shtar amana, they are incriminating themselves and ein odem meisim atzmo rasha. That's fine. If I only had Mar Baravashi, I would be a happy camper. I don't have to rack my brains. It's a very smooth ride. The distinction between eidim who testify amana as opposed to eidim who testify modah is crystal clear. Modah involves no self-incrimination, whereas amana is a violation of eidim and meisim atzma rasha. We can't trust them. But what do I do with Rav Nachman? Rav Nachman says that if the Edom claim it was a shtar moda, even in that case they're not believed. And for this we have to see Tosfos. Alright then? So let's give it a shot. Now, in order to appreciate this Tosfos, I think what we should do is first take a look at Rashi. Because I think Tosfos is standing on the shoulders of Rashi. Rashi says the following. It's approximately, I would say, somewhere between 10 and 15 lines down from the top of the page, the Dibra Maskil is Ein Nem Monem. And Rashi is trying to explain why is it that according to Rav Nachman, when the Edom say that this was a Shtar Modah, they're not believed, says Rashi, Lo Asi Alper Umarile Lishtar. Now I'm going to translate the words of Rashi, but I have to admit to you that until we go through this Tosfos, we have no clue what Rashi's talking about. The language that Rashi employs here is very ambiguous. Says Rashi, Lo Asi Alper Umari Le Lishtari. The testimony, the verbal testimony of the Edim cannot undermine the validity of the Shtar. Yeah, but the question is why? He's still begging the question. After all, they have a Pesh also a Pesh Hitir. Number two, there's no Einon of Mesimats for Russia because they did exactly what they would have to have done in that circumstance. And number three, how, as Aaron asked before, should it be different in the case of Anusimoyi? So what does it mean, Lo Asi Alper, that the verbal testimony of the Edim has no power, Lemari Le Shtari, to ruin the Shtar? Now, once we're on the subject of Rashi, I just want to point out, and maybe this was my mistake for skipping, there's another important Rashi here that I'd like to point out to you. And this is the Amana case. Again, with regard to Amana, with regard to Ishtar Amana, everybody agrees that we don't believe the Edim to say that this is Ishtar Amana. Everybody, I mean both Rav Nachman and Marva Rav Ashi. Rashi says the following. What exactly are the Edim saying about this shtar when they say it's a shtar amon? So if you have it, it's five lines down from the top of the page in Rashi. Rashi says, Edom achsumim b'shtar v'amru amona hayu dvareinu. What does that mean? Lo hilvo klu. The malva never gave a red cent to the lov. Ella kasavnu lo. Why do we write the shtar on behalf of the love? Lichshi yitztarech yilvelo. So that if the love needs the money, then the malva will extend the loan and he has the shtar. Vizeh. Now this word vizeh is referring to the love. Vizeh shibed lo nechasov me'achshav. Rashi's adding a whole shtickle Torah here. You know, sometimes it's quit while you're ahead. As far as I'm concerned, if he didn't start with this vizeh and he had put the point there, everything would be perfect. Rashi says exactly what we understood. But now he says the whole thing. He says, vizeh shibed lo nechasov me'achshav im yilveh afilu yachar zman. Now, it seems that what Rashi's trying to bavarn here, what he's trying to avoid here, is another problem. And that is shtar mukdam, meaning that Edim, when they sign a shtar, they have to make sure that the date on the shtar is accurate. And if they don't do so, that shtar becomes a shtar mukdam, which is pasul. So let's say, for example, the shtar has an earlier date than the matan mos, than the actual loan. Now the loan establishes what's called a shibud. In English it's called a lien, L-I-E-N, which allows the malva to collect from the lekuchos, but he can only collect from lekuchos who purchased the karka, the lova, subsequent to the matan mos, to the loan itself. But if the date on the shtar predates the loan, then you're cheating the lekuchos, because the shibud is not, does not emerge until after the loan was given, and the date on the shtar is an earlier date. This, for example, is a classical issue in ksuba, because what you have is very often where the rabbi gets together with the edim and the husband, and they write up the ksuba, and it's not yet nightfall.
Right.
But the ksuba is dependent upon the marriage itself. Before the marriage, the marriage took place after nightfall, so that makes it into a whole problem of a shtar mukdam, because the ksuba can be collected by the isha or by her lekucha, or by the lekuchas of the baal who bought the karka from the baal, from the time it's written in the ksuba. And that's not good, because there was never a shibud at that time, because the matmos took place later. So that's called the psul of shtar muktam. So Rashi says that this shtar, called the shtar amana, is not a shtar muktam. Lav muktam lehevi litrov shalom kedin. In other words, Rashi wants to make sure that we understand that within the context of the testimony of this Edim, they are not invalidating the shtar per se. In other words, the shtar as an entity, if not for the fact that they're telling us the whole story about Amana, but the shtar as an entity unto itself is a valid shtar. In other words, Rashi is saying, don't allow the following thought to enter and cross your brain, that the shtar amana itself is possible b'torah shtar muktam. Now, why isn't it a shtar muktam? After all, the loan hasn't yet been forthcoming, and the date on the shtar presumably reflects the date in which the lova commissioned the eidim to write up the shtar. At this point in time, the malva hasn't yet given over the money, so l'chor it should be a shtar muktam. So I just want to read to you, I have the Ran here in the back, or at least the summary of the Ran, and he writes the following, Delav muktam havi lichov shalokidin, hashtaru kosher. Rashi's telling me that the shtar is kosher. The eno shtar muktam, shatarech hakosuv bo, meaning a shtar muktam means that the date on the shtar, eno azman ha-miti shalvoy al-kodim l'chein, the date is earlier than the actual matan mos in which the loan was extended. Shupasul mishum sheyovo shemiyovo amhamal veligvos minichos mishubodim shemachram alova liachar azman hamiti shel halva umedin ein lo schus ligvos minichos mishubodim rak osam minichos shemachram alova liachar azman halva sharei b'shtars. Okay, so again, what's a shtar muktam and why is it possible? The date precedes the actual matan mos, mikashash, then the malva is going to be able to be gover from a shubadim that was sold by the lova. Shemachram al lova. Liachar hazman amiti shalva. Minadin, enlo schus ligvos minichos mishvon kak osam. Liachar hazman. Shemachram alov liachar zman halva. I don't know, the language here is a little bit difficult, but I think I get the point that if it's a shtar muktam, then the malva is going to use this shtar illegally to collect from the lekuchos who bought the karka of the lova before the lova actually got the loan. But this shtar, the shtar mona, is okay. Why? Shezeh shtar. Vishtar zeh tarich hanokubo huzman Sivaso ha'amiti u'me'oz mishtabdim mechasov la'malve minadin. So shtar mukta means that the shtar was written today with yesterday's date, and that's not acceptable. That's already a shtar post. But here, the date that's written on the shtar is the actual date in which the shtar was written. V'im yilvelo malve mos li'achar mikan ein ha'idim. Okay, fine. But ze omrim shechosmo al shtar mona, right? Shosalaske mitam sheyochol lotzeis mikach takola. She yovo ligvos bo shelo kidin af shelo yovolo samos av a lo mitam shu shtar mukton. So this is not considered a shtar muktam. So Rashi solves the problem here of a shtar muktam by telling us that the shibud of the nechasim was chal now, from the time of the writing of the shtar, even though the lova hasn't yet received the money. Now I'm not exactly sure how, with what kinyan that shibud is chal, because normally the kinyan of shibudim is chal with the shtar. And here the shtar wasn't even given over to the malfer. So it might be what's called Edov b'chasum of Zochinlo. Are you familiar with that concept? That's a sugi of Metzia. That Zochin Yodim Shalom Befadov, the Edom can represent the malfer on his own behalf to collect or to clinch the kinyan on the shibudim, so that the malfer could have the shibudim from the time of the writing of the shtar. That's called Edov b'chasum of Zochinlo. Alright, now let's look at Tosfos, okay? Can everybody tune in now? Because this is the punchline of the whole Shia. Tosfos says the following. Omar Rav Nachman, Eidim Shomru Amonu Hayutvarenu Ein Ne'emonim. Al Korchenu, Be'ein Ksav Yodom Yotzi Mokam Acharari. The case means, must be talking about a scenario in which there's no independent source for authenticating the shtar. If we can compare this shtar and its signatures to other shtaros, then pshita, then for sure the Edom wouldn't be believed. The Hachi Parch Liel, as the Gemara asked before. In other words, once the shtar is mekuyim, the Edom can't say anything about the shtar. That's for sure. And they don't have a peshas and peshita. Viod, and furthermore, the Mabra Vashi, so the Edom can't say anything about the shtar to shtar makuya because of Kevin Shehigin, only if they have a pesha asar. So the whole discussion here about whether they should be believed, and Ravashi, Mar Ravashi says they can't be believed because they're incriminating themselves. What do you need that for? If it's a case of ksav yodim yotzim mochamach and the shtar is makuyim, then they're not believed because okay, fine. So basically, that's the introduction to Tosa's question. Now that we've established that this sugya of Rav Nachman and Mar Barvashi is discussing a case of Ein Ksav Yodim Yotzi Makom Acher, let's compare it now to our Mishnah. The Kasha, the Amai Lo Mehemni. Why shouldn't we believe the Edim? Bin Migu. Migu means Pesha Asa Pesha Hitir. Dor Rav Nachman Gufei Isleliel Migu Lifsol Es Ashtar. Dika Omar Ki Asa Lekami Dedine Amrina Le Zilu Kami Shtarai Chubichas Ledine. De Mehemon Lomar Parua Bimigu De Mizuya For Kolshkein Eidim Tal Lime Leruye Shtara. So that just like the Lova is believed to say Parua according to Rav Nachman against the Shtar She'eno Makuyo, because he has the Migu, he could have said it was Mizuyov. How much more so the Edom should be believed with a Migu, in which case we don't understand why the Gemara rules out the Nemonis of the Edom when they come to be Makayim the Shtar and Ein Ksav Yodim Yotzi Makom Acher, and they say Amona Hayu Dvarenu or Moda Hayu Dvarenu. The Tirates Re. The Hainu Taima de Moda, why are they not believed to say Moda? Hoil Umodim Shashtar Nichtav Vinimsar Kehilchaso Shuvlo Osi Alpe Umari Lishtore. That sentence should sound familiar to you. That was the ambiguous statement we saw in Rashi, but now I think we can begin to unravel the mystery. What the Ri is saying is that a Shtar Moda in and of itself, in other words, as far as the creation of the shtar is concerned, is a shtar kosher. Because in fact, the lova did commission the writing of the shtar, or in the case of a mocher, the mocher did commission the writing of the shtar. And therefore, the shtar is a shtar kosher in and of itself. And the Edom aren't denying, when they claim odah, the kashrus of the shtar. And therefore, shuvlom osi al peu marilu l'shtari afil b'migu. Now they cannot be believed, even with a migu, against the shtar, because they, by their own admission, have validated the shtar. The shtar is not mezuyif because they admit Ksav Yadenu, who said the shtar was written by the mocher, because in the case of Modah, the Edom admit that that they were commissioned and mandated to write the shtar. Why is it that the Mishnah establishes in Ein Ksav Yadim Mokom Acher that the Edom are believed to invalidate the shtar with a pesh also pesh hitir? How is that different, Aaron? This is your question. Than the case of Modah, he says there in the case of our Mishnah, Eino Modim Shiyeh Shtar Shohayah Shtar Kosher El Sosrin Oso. What they're saying now is that the shtar in its very creation was an invalid shtar. Why? Because it was created ba'onis. And if the Edom signed ba'onis, that's a shtar without valid signatures. Or, for example, if the Edom were ketanim or psulim, then there's no edus on the shtar. So the shtar per se is posel. Hilkach mehemne. Why? Because since they have the credibility and the support of a migu of pesha asar, they're not contradicted by a shtar, because they deny the validity of the shtar by saying that the edus on the shtar is invalid. Is lo shayach tan lomar in our mission of anusim ayinu? We cannot apply the principle of lo osi al peh umari le l'shtare. Sharei eino modim shahaya shtar. What we need is a hodah that this was a valid shtar. To create a hodah that this was a valid shtar, we need A, to know that the Edom actually signed the shtar, B, that they were gedolim and akhtanim, C, they were rechokim and akrovim, and D, they signed the shtar mirtzonom hatov and not meonis. But in this case of modah, what they admit is that all the qualifications and all the conditions necessary for a shtar kosher were fulfilled. And now, once they admit that the shtar is a valid shtar, they can't come up with a pesha osa pesha yitir to contradict the shtar, because the shtar will testify against the pesha osa pesha yitir. And the shtar yells out, I am not a shtar modah. The amana nami. Now, Tosis' goal, in order to explain why they're not believed to say amana, and that's true according to Rav Nachman, and he's not operating within the framework of Eino the Mesim Atzma Rosha. So Tosis logically is going to have to conclude that even a shtar amona in and of itself is a shtar kosher. Nami nire dahainu taimid lo mehemni rav nachman lo mari l'shtar ahol umodim shashtar nichtav kiddin. What does that mean, kiddin? Number one, it was written and signed by two Edom. These Edom were ksherim. They were not ketanim. They were not psulim. They were not anusim. And not only that, the das hamischayef to create the shtar was there. Why? Because they were commissioned by the lova to write the shtar. And even by the admission of the Edom, the lova did commission them to write the shtar. Umodim, the Edom admit, and they agree, shashtar nichtav kiddin midas halova midas hamischayef, is therefore they themselves are validating the shtar as an entity. Meaning, the requirements and the conditions to create an entity of a shtar were all fulfilled. Once the Edom admit that, then the shtar will testify against anything that will come to pasul the shtar, because now the shtar is immunized. You know, it's got all the power. And once it has all the power, it can fight and repel any question on the kashrus of the shtar. And that gives it the validity, the token of an edus. And a pesha osar, pesha yitir, with all due respect, is not believed against edus. But in the case of anusim, ketanim, or psuli edus, there what the edim are saying is that the shtar itself was not kosher. There was no valid signatures of edim on the shtar. Because the Edom were compelled, or because the Edom were krovim, or because the Edom were minors, were ketan. Wow. This is an unbelievable situation. And Tosis making a fundamental division that only Tosis can make, that the principle of Pesha Asa Pesha Hiter operates when the Edom are saying about the shtar that it wasn't created according to the laws and requirements of a shtar. But if the Edom admit that the shtar was created with all the conditions fulfilled, then the principle is, and this undermines the Pesha Asa Pesha Hiter, Lo Asi Al Peh Umare B'shtare, which means that with all due respect to the Al Peh, to the verbal testimony of the Edom, which is has a lot of credibility to it. Hapesha sa peshiti. It's a shtar she'ein k'sav yodim yotzei makom acher. But nevertheless, they themselves, the Edim, have admitted that Mari Leilishtari, that they are now coming to contradict a valid shtar. They have validated the shtar. All the conditions to the creation of the shtar have been met. My problem, this is only Berzon with this Tosus, and this is where it boggles my mind, is that what does it mean to have a Das HaMeschayev in the case of a shtar amana? The Das HaMeschayev, the Lova, was that if and when I receive the loan, then I'm Meschayev. No, Tosus says there's a separate halach of Das HaMeschayev for the creation of the shtar, and that the Lova had. Then we get to Modah. What are we saying? That the Mocher commissioned the Edim to write the shtar and sign the shtar, and therefore that makes it into a shtar with all the conditions therein? Baba Meisach, can you say such a thing? They were compelled, the Mocher was compelled at the face of death to write up this shtar mecher. That's called a Das HaMeschayev? When my Das HaMeschayev is a Das of Onus? The Gemara all over Shas says that Das for Onus is not a Das. If I'm compelled to agree to a transaction, that's not called Das. So I leave you with that question. But in any event, Tosus holds that both in Amana and in Modah, the principle is Lo Osi Al Peh Umari Lishtar. Okay, Rabosai, we'll stop here.